From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Federal workers who were off work for some 35 days are going back to work today. The president has reopened the government in a short-term deal last Friday that did not include funding for a border wall, but the battle continues. Also on Friday, Roger Stone became the sixth person close to the president to be charged in Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Then over the weekend in Oakland, California Senator Kamala Harris held her first rally in her campaign to be president. Cap Radio's Ben Adler and Andrew Nixon were at the rally. In a few minutes, Ben is going to join us and join this conversation with Ken Rudin, which we have every week. The political junkie is standing by in the Washington, D.C. area. So much to cover today. Hello, Ken.
Good morning, Beth. Could you think of, just think of what's happened since the last time we were on the air together? My goodness, it's like it just never stops.
It's a completely different chapter in politics, in fact, and I'm going to get to that because the way it sets up the presidential race now. But let me go to something you posted on Twitter, Ken. You made somewhat of a mathematical equation about what has happened with the reopening of the government. You wrote, TSA situation at LaGuardia plus Republican defections plus Pelosi resolve plus the Stone indictment equal the end of the shutdown. So I want to start with why the TSA situation at LaGuardia Airport in New York was so powerful in this equation.
Well, I mean, first of all, there were horror stories around the country about people who just could not pay their bills, could not afford food. I mean, Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, talked about, you know, why don't they just go get loans or something like that? Or why would they have to go to a food bank? But anyway, I mean, the headlines were bad. But once we saw what was happening at LaGuardia Airport in New York, which is a bad enough airport as it is, to see all these flight delays, the lining up of planes on the runway that were delayed because of the shutdown, the headlines were getting worse and worse, and it became not only financial, but it also became dangerous, and I think that was crossing a tipping line there.
The Republican defections included a California assemblyman who moved from the Republican Party to the Democratic side. It wasn't only Brian Manshine, though. That happened across the country, too.
Well, there were several defections. First of all, on Capitol Hill, when the Democrats put up their bill in the Senate to reopen the government, six Republican senators defected, including Susan Collins and Cory Gardner of Colorado, senators who were up for re-election. So they defected from the Republican Party. But as well, you also have the situations around the country with Brian Manshine in California, in Kansas. Well, this was actually more in December, but given the fact that what was going on with the unfavorable headlines, you had three members of the state legislature in Kansas, Ruby Red Kansas, who defected to the Democratic Party. Now, it's one thing for maybe a Manshine who's from San Diego to defect to the Democratic Party because the Democrats overwhelmingly run the California legislature. I think his number made it now 61 Democrats out of the 80 seats. But when you have Republican legislators in Ruby Red Kansas switching parties as well, it shows that there's dissatisfaction in the grand old party around the country.
All right, Nancy Pelosi's resolve in the standoff with President Trump. How has that situation played for her politically? She said she was going to reveal a power in a woman legislator, in her, that the president probably, she said, underestimated.
Well, I think a lot of people did. I think even her fellow Democrats underestimated her. Remember, so many Democrats, not a majority, of course, but there was a good sizable number of Democrats who ran for Congress in 2018 saying that I'm not going to vote for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker if the Democrats should take a majority. She's too old. She's been around too long. She's been in the leadership for 15 years. We need new blood. Well, if anybody stood up to President Trump during the shutdown, especially politically, and it certainly wasn't his own party, it was Nancy Pelosi. And I think the fact that she did not back down one inch and the fact that so many people are so afraid of the president, I think that her standing is just, you know, probably higher than it's ever been. And even though she's put on a self-imposed 4-year limit as Speaker. Right now, she stands taller than anybody else politically. Look, it's more than Trump versus Pelosi, and a lot of journalists tried to make it a power play between the two of them. Obviously, we're talking about the economy. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who, you know, who were this shutdown was adversely affecting. Right. But Nancy Pelosi really stood up to the plate, and she hit it out of the park.
I'm going to get to Roger Stone in a moment, but what you didn't put in your equation, Ken, was that the president's approval rating was falling down, 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 too.
That's absolutely true. There's a new Associated Press. I mean, the polls are all over the place. Like NBC has a poll showing the president with 43% approval. That's higher than anything else I saw. There's a new AP poll out that shows him 34%. The president of the United States, 34% approval, with his standing among Republicans under 80%, which is also a giant a letdown from what his numbers had been showing. So when you're losing your own Republican Party, look, 80% is not bad, but considering it used to be at like 98%, when there's a fallout among his fellow Republicans, in addition to only 34% of the American public, you know that he's fighting a losing battle, and I think everybody in the White House, perhaps even the President of the United States, understood that.
I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Roger Stone was arrested late last week, pled not guilty to the charges, which include lying under oath. He was released on bond. And then, Ken, he was all over the airwaves, all over the weekend. So I'm going to play a little bit from ABC this week. You're going to first hear the host, George Stephanopoulos, talking to Roger Stone.
And just to be clear, have you destroyed or discarded any communications devices, wiped any hard drives clean since the campaign?
Categorically not. My lawyers have been insistent on this. We very early had a request from both the Senate and the House. We have destroyed nothing whatsoever.
You say you won't bear false witness against President Trump. Are you prepared to tell the truth about your dealings with him to the special counsel, your truth about your dealings with the campaign? Any chance you'll cooperate with special counsel Robert Mueller if he asks?
You know, that's a question I would have to determine after my attorneys have some discussion. If there's wrongdoing by other people in the campaign that I know about, which I know of none, but if there is, I would certainly testify honestly. I'd also testify honestly about any other matter, including any communications with the president. It's true that we spoke on the phone, but those communications are political in nature, they're benign, and there is certainly no conspiracy with Russia. The president's right. There is no Russian
collusion.
And
he's never suggested to you in any way, shape, or form that he might offer you a pardon?
Absolutely, positively not. I have never discussed a pardon. The only person that I had advocated a pardon for, as we've discussed previously, is a posthumous pardon for Marcus Garvey, and I have written the president as to why I think that should be done.
All right, Marcus Garvey is a separate story, but tell me your take on Roger Stone and how he's positioning himself, including a website where you can add to his defense fund if you want to contribute.
Well, first of all, I'll be very careful because I know there are libel laws in this country, but suggesting that Roger Stone tell the truth is almost like a fool's errand. He's shown, first of all, among the indictments, it shows that he's lying to Congress. There's so many first of alls with Roger Stone. He said he would never testify against President Trump. I noticed that Stephanopoulos didn't ask him anything about what he did with WikiLeaks, which is perhaps behind the whole thing as well, but the whole indictment as well regarding WikiLeaks backed by Russia, stolen emails from the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. But suggesting Roger Stone that he's not going to lie, he has spent a lifetime of embellishing and twisting the truth in ways that very few people have. So I would look at Roger Stone's so-called testimony on ABC News on Sunday quite skeptically, and we'll just see what the Mueller investigation has.
In that same hour, in fact, back-to-back with Roger Stone was California Congressman Adam Schiff, who's chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and he gave his take on what he had just heard Roger Stone say.
White-collar defendants always make some variation of the same argument, and that is, I have a perfectly innocent explanation for this fact. And as for this other fact, I can come up with an innocent explanation for that. And likewise for all these other facts. But whatever you do, don't look at their totality. But when you look at the totality of what's going on here, and you look at the chronology, we know that the Russians told the Trump campaign as early as April of 2016 that they had the stolen emails. We know that they offered dirt to the president's son, Don Jr., and he said he would love to have the Russian government help with that. And then we know that some person directed a senior campaign official to reach out to Roger Stone to find out what WikiLeaks had gotten from the Russians. And then, of course, you have the president publicly calling for the Russians to help with those stolen emails. And all of this taking place while Donald Trump is pursuing what would probably be the most lucrative deal of his entire life, and one that requires Kremlin approval, this Moscow Trump Tower.
I think those two pieces of sound really lay out what this battle is, Ken.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Roger Stone from the beginning was bragging about his relationship with the Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and what he knew. And then, of course, when the investigators got closer and closer to him, he said, well, it was either hypothetical or I was just suggesting things or I really wasn't saying it. Roger Stone loves to self-promote. He always has. Remember when he came out right after he was arrested, he did the both arms up with the V for Victory, the Richard Nixon salute, which, of course, he's always loved. You know, he has a Richard Nixon tattoo on his back. He always adored President Nixon. But I think Adam Schiff has it closer than Roger Stone does, in the sense that there are serious questions about what the campaign did vis-a-vis with Russia and what the Trump organization did regarding building complexes in Russia. And maybe that's one of the reasons why Trump was insisting on lessening of the Obama sanctions against Moscow, because he was doing business with them. So that's something that Adam Schiff and the House Intelligence Committee are going to investigate. And certainly that's something that Robert Mueller is investigating.
So the big picture, again, of what's unfolded the last couple of weeks does widen, you might say, the window of opportunity for anybody that wants to run for president in 2020. And with that, I'm going to bring Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler into the conversation. Ben, say hello to Ken. Ken,
hello.
Hi to Ben.
Hello to Ken.
Hi, Ben.
So Ben attended this rally in Oakland, the first big rally for California Senator Kamala Harris as now an official candidate for president. Set the scene, Ben, because a lot is being made that her first big rally attracted a bigger crowd than Barack Obama's did when he started his campaign to become president.
So I've seen a lot fewer presidential campaigns launched than Ken, and that's a nice way of me not talking about age, but experience and wisdom.
Nice
and
try, Ben.
This one jumped out at me for the size, the scope, the choreography, the planning. Kamala Harris's campaign wants to portray her as a front runner. That comes with both risks and rewards. The risks being that you have a target on your back, everyone is going after you, and the rewards being that you get additional media spotlight and momentum and potentially fundraising. There's no doubt that based on the 20,000 plus people who showed up in Oakland yesterday, albeit in the heart of her political base, that Kamala Harris is seeking to come out of the gates saying, look, I'm the candidate to beat in the Democratic primary to take on Donald Trump in 2020. You had flags of all 50 states set against the backdrop of Oakland City Hall, countless American flags, and the backdrop was all there.
She's talking about this time in big history, but she's talking about the time specific in this presidency, in this history, and why there has to be a change.
And let's listen. I think this cut right here kind of portrays part of her message.
And we are here at this moment in time because we must answer a fundamental question. Who are we? Who are we as Americans? So let's answer that question to the world and each other right here and right now. America, we are better than this. better than this.
And you can hear that crowd coming in loud right there. Kamala Harris, her campaign slogan, "For the People," it's intended to weave together into this narrative the way that the best presidential candidates seemingly have a narrative that can be consistent through the primary and the general elections, and that cuts across various parts of their lives and comes together in this one seamless theme. And for Harris, she is seeking to make that theme for the people, representing her time as a prosecutor. Now, she also came out and talked about the importance of the word truth. And that is, I think, a clear contrast that she is seeking to make with President Trump.
Our United States of America is not about us versus them. It's about we, the people. And in this moment, we must all speak truth about what is happening. We must seek truth, speak truth, and fight for the truth.
So, Ken, I'd like to get your take on the start of this campaign, but you have to say, for anyone else who's been hedging and just forming their exploratory committee or not sure, maybe they missed a moment, because her presence in actually being a candidate right now, when all of what's happening in Washington is happening, is something she can capitalize on in a way that others can't.
Yeah, you know something, I was very interested in everything that Ben, how Ben described it. He said two things that stood out to me. First of all, he said that, you know, it was a larger crowd than Obama, when Obama announced in 2016, 2017. And basically, it reminded me of Obama in the sense, of course, she is a person of color, and she's only been in the Senate 2 years, but she excites the crowd. And I saw clips of that rally in Oakland. And it did seem to dwarf what we saw with Obama announcing in Springfield, although if memory serves, that Springfield announcement, it was bitter, bitter cold. But she does have a way. I mean, she's articulate. We saw her with a tough questioning during the Kavanaugh hearings. She knows what she's saying. She's very experienced and smart and tough. But at the same time, Ben also mentioned the fact that she was a prosecutor, and that may be her... maybe not her vulnerability, but certainly the progressive left wing have been talking that Kamala Harris, when she was district attorney of San Francisco, when she was attorney general of California, she pursued policies that may have been so tough on crime that it overwhelmingly affected African Americans in the state, in a bad way, and that some progressives are holding that against her, but. Again, I don't know if other presidential candidates, would-be presidential candidates, have lost an opportunity. There's plenty of time. Obviously, they have to get in the race before June because that's when the debates begin in earnest.
Right.
And so we're still waiting for the Bernie Sanders and, I guess, the BBBs, right? Bernie, Biden, and Beto.
Yeah.
We haven't heard from them yet, nor have we heard from Cory Booker, but I don't think it's too late. There's plenty of time for people to have their day in the sun, but it's going to be probably the most widely diverse presidential field in history. And I guess, you know, anybody who loves politics, the more the merrier.
So it was Kamala Harris's press secretary that tweeted that more than 20,000 people were at the event, saying thousands more are in overflow lines. And the Washington Examiner reported that back in 2007, when then Senator Obama announced, that it was estimated between 15,000 and 17,000 people showing up. So I don't want that to be a bigger storyline than it needs to be. But the point being, and as you were saying, Ben, that her candidacy is being received with such big open arms, even though Kamala Harris might not be the only Californian that ends up in this race.
So we know that Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti is taking steps to position himself as a possible candidate, although he had to put that on hold a little bit with the Los Angeles teachers strike. So we'll wait to see what happens there. We know that Gavin Newsom reiterated once again the other day he is not running for president. And another Californian who we know had been eyeing a potential race, that being billionaire Tom Steyer, he has also said he's not a candidate for president at this time.
So,
and isn't there, what about Congressman Eric Swalwell? Isn't he talking about running as well? He has people in Iowa and New Hampshire as well, I believe.
I think you're right. I think I saw something about that, but he hasn't gotten quite the media attention as some of the other candidates.
Ken, do you think Michael Bloomberg jumps in? And what about Starbucks founder Howard Schultz?
Well, if anybody who watched 60 Minutes yesterday, I was fascinated by it, because unlike Bloomberg, who's like $48 billion, and he said he would self-fund his campaign should he run, Schultz is saying if he ran, he would run as a centrist independent. Now, for somebody like Schultz, who is also a billionaire, who's talking about getting on the ballot in all 50 states, if he ran as an independent, that would mean he would run against Donald Trump and against the Democratic nominee. And he says, if it's Joe Biden, that's one thing. But if it's a left-wing Democrat, and I don't know what that means, does that mean Kamala Harris? Does it mean Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren? I have no idea what it means, but it means that he could split the anti-Trump vote. And I think there are a lot of liberal Democrats or Democrats who say, no, you want to run as an independent and hurt the Democratic Party. Watch for the biggest boycott of Starbucks in history, because we're not going to take this sitting down.
All right, guys, I want to thank you both for kicking off the week. Who knows what we're in store for this week? But Ben, glad to have you join us in this conversation. Ken, it's always a pleasure. So, guys, say goodbye until next time.
Until next time.
Well, I said the three B's were Biden, Beto, and Bernie. I want to say goodbye to Beth and Ben.
Oh, there we go. Neither of us are candidates for president of the United
for
States.
Anything at
Not
this
yet.
Point.
Anything. Thoroughly.
All right.
Thoroughly.
Thanks, Ken. Take care. And Ben, thank you, too.
You're welcome.
And I will say that you can see Andrew Nixon's photos of the Kamala Harris rally, along with more coverage from Ben at capradio.org. This is Insight on Cap Radio.